Why is it, do you think, children are always too young to hear the truth, but never too young to be lied to systematically, conscientiously, in the name of education?
This is Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org.
Working poor, no more can we ignore who we working for, who we fighting for, who we dying for. We all know the score, it's for the uppers to have more. Said you heard it before. Said the rich get rich and the poor get poor. Jump up and grab a mic and say you gotta get yours. Life ain't shit, you gotta work for yours. You gotta hustle from the bottom just to feed the poor. Said it's a class war. Said it's a class war.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Class conscious. Class conscious. Class conscious.
Hey there. You are listening to Teachers for Class War. We've got an exciting program for you. We will be talking to Karen Lewis, who is co-chair of CORE, which is the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, which is based in Chicago, which is actually, we're going to find out exactly how it works, but it's kind of a little, it's a caucus of the teachers union in Chicago. She ran elections for a steering committee as one of the, on one of the planks as the, wait, what does that mean? So she's part of the caucus pushing for member democracy, which means that there should be no leaders of the union. Everybody should be equal, I think is what that means. She was also a speaker at No Games Chicago panel, which is speaking out against Chicago as a host city for the Olympic Games, on how the games would negatively impact Chicago students. And while we get her on the phone, we are going to listen to a little bit of music from Oaxaca, from the teachers there.
In a crazy way, it's a class war. Said it's a class war.
Class war.
Monetary mental. Oaxaca de mis amores, ay que tropezón me di por andar toreando a Ulises, que es el maldito de aquí. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que solo el pueblo será testigo. Me gusta dormir en alto pa' pasearme en la azotea y gritarle al güey de Ulises que aquí está quien lo torea. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que todo el pueblo será testigo. La boca le sabe a sangre y las manos a panteón. Cuando mira a los maestros se le baja hasta el calzón. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que todo el pueblo será testigo. Somos las siete regiones las que vamos a luchar en contra del mal gobierno que nos quiere pisotear. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que solo el pueblo será testigo. Hay gobiernos gobernados, hijos del gobierno aquel, se pelean por los huesitos para quedarse con él. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que todo el pueblo será testigo. Somos todos oaxaqueños, humildes de corazón, ganaremos esta lucha a pesar de represión. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que todo el pueblo será
sea testigo. Ulises pegó un reparo y en el aire se detuvo. Hay bueyes que tienen madre, pero este ni madre tuvo. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que solo el pueblo será testigo. Tengo listo mi garrote para poderme defender de los pinches granaderos y echarlos a correr. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que solo el pueblo será testigo. Ya con esta me despido, ya me voy a mi plantón, pa' estar a la expectativa por si llega ese cabrón. Verdad de Dios, que se los digo, que solo el pueblo será testigo.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. This is Teachers for Class War every Monday at 6 o'clock. And as our other host mentioned, the four of us in here, Karen Lewis is on the phone, co-chair of CORE, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators in Chicago. Karen, welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. We want to start out by asking you a little bit about the general structure and history of the caucus of rank and file educators. Is it within the separate teachers union, or is it the union itself?
No, we are a caucus within the Chicago Teachers Union. We felt that the leadership of Chicago Teachers Union had not addressed some of the really important issues that that were affecting membership. So a small group of people got together and formed basically a study group, because, you know, what do teachers do? We study. And we started branching out and talking to more people, and we ended up having a huge organizing meeting where we came up with five basic planks. And but our main focus has always been to kind of bring the leadership into a more activist role, because right now they're not, and that's unfortunate.
And so I understand part of the platform then is some transparency and accountability for the union leadership?
Absolutely. We have basically a five pronged approach. We believe that the union should be a member-driven union, because once it's top-down, then it's exactly like the Board of Education. We don't need that. Transparency and accountability, one of our biggest problems is that there's always been a lot of backroom deals going on that the membership knows nothing about. And one of our big problems is that we had a huge, huge financial deficit. These people were spending money like water, our dues membership, and before we knew it, we were $3 million in debt. And if you look at the way we started with a $5 million surplus when they took office, and then within 4 years, we're now in debt $3 million. That's $8 million that have disappeared. We believe in partnerships. We're the only caucus that seeks to have input of parents, students, and the community. And we believe in strongly defending publicly funded public education and not this privatization that's going on in terms of charters and contract schools and whoever else has a great idea this week. And then our last prong of our plank is that we have a strong contract, because a strong contract is all about quality education ultimately. So that's our basics.
One of the things that I noticed reading a little bit about it, specifically about transparency and accountability, is that CORE was interested in a requirement or some kind of developing rules that made it clear that union leadership would also be classroom teachers and that their compensation wouldn't be a little extra on the top.
Oh, yeah. Well, what they're making right now is almost obscene. I mean, we have, not only do they have a salary that's fairly high, that is not commensurate with what classroom teachers do, they also get a 14% tax sheltered annuity that's paid for. There's a $1,500 a month car allowance, for example. These are some of the extra perks. Whether you use it or not, you get this $1,500 check. And at one point, They had an unlimited expense account. That has actually been reined in. But, again, as the co-chair Jackson Potter says, these people were not only asleep at the wheel, they were joyriding. So, and on our dime. So, yeah, that was a real problem. And it's still a problem because they're still in office.
I would love to hear more about the process of organizing around issues like what you were just talking about. I feel like in our district, sometimes we have a lot of radical teachers who close the door and rebel in their teaching, but mm-hmm. don't necessarily mm-hmm. identify each other too late to actually do anything. And I'm interested mm-hmm. in that process of you all identifying each other and organizing together without
you
feeling...
You know, it's tough. We started out as about 6 or 7 people, literally, coming together at like a luncheon. And we started talking. And we started talking to other people, and it's one of those things where I don't know if you guys are familiar with Jenny Sims, who is she's a former president of the British Columbia Teachers Federation. And Jenny Sims had a brilliant idea. She said, tell 5 people. And if you're telling 5 people and those 5 people tell 5 people, then guess what? You're going to all of a sudden get people who are listening to what's going on and saying, this may be the home that I'm looking for. And I certainly felt that way. So it starts small, and it starts tiny, and then all of a sudden, guess what? It starts mushrooming, because when you are honest, when you are articulate, when you are strong in your beliefs, and you're saying the same things, you're on the same page, because it's what you believe, then all of a sudden, you have some authenticity and some credibility, and people want to be a part of what you're a part of. So, I mean, and a lot of it has to do with being civilized and being straightforward and honest and out front. And it is amazing how people respond to that. But as you know, teachers are extraordinarily autonomous, and it's so easy to go in your classroom and shut your door and say, I don't want to hear about the union, I don't want to do anything with it, they don't do anything for me. And trust me, this is not a battle that has not been fought yet. We are still in our infancy, and we're still working, but we have affected some change because the leadership has taken notice and has seen what it is that we're doing, and they've had to respond. I mean, and that is ultimately what happens, is that... Is that you see that there has to be something else, and you speak that constantly. So you will have people that will come to you and say, you know what, I like what you're saying. Can you tell me more? And that's when teachers need to make a little investment and buy some business cards, because you know we don't get those. Mm-hmm. And start passing them out. Call me. You know, come to our website. Come look at see what we're doing.
So is the relationship between you all and the Chicago's Teachers Union, is it explicitly sort of antagonistic or?
Sure. We are an opposition caucus. There's no doubt about it. We have actually had to work together on some things. We've actually invited them to be a part of partnership. And then as soon as it didn't suit their needs, they were disappearing. I mean, it's not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So people are saying, well, you know, you did all this work and they took credit for it. Who cares? The work got done, and that's what's important.
Right.
And ultimately we will get credit because they haven't done anything else. So when we see, for years, we had schools being turned around and shut down and closed, and our union did absolutely nothing. This past year, we were able to take 6 schools off the hit list. And our organization, CORE, was the only union face at any of the rallies. We went to every single sham hearing that the Board of Education put out. We had somebody there, and we called them out for what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, the union leadership is worried about what we'll do. They think we're marginalized because we protest, and you know, we do things like we had a great picket of Arne Duncan coming to town on Friday. So. And again, Arne Duncan would not be the Secretary of Education of this country without the advice and consent of the Chicago Teachers Union. Don't think for a minute that, you know, people did nod and smile and agree to that mm-hmm. and not call him out for the weak sister that he is.
That's actually one of the points on my list. I'd love to get more background on Arne Duncan from your mm-hmm. perspective, and I'd love to have more details from the action.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let me just give you a quick and dirty background on Arne Duncan. He is completely and totally unqualified to lead any school system. He could not legally walk in my classroom and interview me and evaluate me. He could not legally do it because he's not qualified to do so. And to me, to have someone like this in charge of a school system is beyond ridiculous. So now he's in charge of all of the school system, which, you know, to me is absolutely incredible. I don't understand it. So if educators and if the whole process of education is flawed, then why do we keep turning out EDDs and people who have been through sort of, you know, some sort of certification program? What's the point of it then? If we have someone who can come in and now say, okay, I can look at these data, and they tell me this. And yet we can go cook the books if we don't like it. All of a sudden the test scores started flattening out. So what did? They changed the test. Mm-hmm. Oh, and now we have increases in scores again. It's because the people at the top have no clue what this means. So Arne Duncan has pushed this lie. And here's the other part that is so annoying. This so-called Chicago miracle, this turnaround that he's done, this, oh, the test scores have improved. They are all lies if you look at the real research. And I will be glad to send you them. I unfortunately have nothing in front of me as I speak, so I probably sound like I'm talking off the top of my head. But trust me, I am not. The research is very clear. The charter schools, the turnaround schools, the contract schools do not do any better than the neighborhood schools that they are replacing. They don't do any better. And in some cases, they do actually worse. So the problem is what Arne Duncan has done, and this whole idea, oh, let's close bad schools. Well, you know, on paper, it sounds fabulous. And let's open up something better. On paper, it sounds fabulous. That's not what's happening, though. It is absolutely not what's happening.
Right, and I think that charter schools don't yet have the track record in a lot of cases to prove anything.
But they have enough. They have data. They've been around for a minute now. So if you've been around since 2003, you have some data now that we can look at and examine and study. So the idea that charter schools don't have track records is also patently, patently false. They do.
Uh-huh.
In the beginning, they weren't even publishing their scores because they were so low and mm-hmm. scary. So, of course, you know, but then once they had to start publishing this, or what they do here is they aggregate the scores. So if you have one company that has 7 or 8 campuses, you've got 2 campuses that are doing really, really well. But then you have 5 or 6 campuses that are doing horribly. If you have all this data aggregated, it looks fabulous.
Uh-huh.
But then if you disaggregate the data and you look at each individual school, you start to see a completely different picture. The problem is if the books are cooked and all this Enron accounting practices that are going on, then this is the kind of stuff you're going to have. But Arne Duncan's miracle is not a miracle. What it has done is destabilized neighborhoods. We have this huge increase now in children crossing gang territories to get to new schools or not being able to go to the school that's right across the street from their houses because it's a charter school and it has some sort of attendance requirement or some sort of selective admission component or your parent has to come in and work a certain amount of times a week. So, I mean, there's tons of stuff that show that this so-called miracle is hardly a miracle. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors and very good media that have bought into and gone for the okey-doke on this.
How would you advise teachers in our area? I teach in Watsonville, which is in large respects a totally disadvantaged population both linguistically and economically, and we're starting to see that, you know, we're in program improvement year 5 or 6 or wherever we're at. Charter schools are starting to crop up. How would you advise radical teachers on this coast to start organizing against that?
Well, one of the things you have to realize is that you have to get parents and students and community and community organizations with you. You cannot do this alone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is the one problem that teachers have, because here's the problem. The teacher bashing is so fever-pitched right now from the media, from a lot of uninformed people. Well, you know, the teachers are just bad. You know, you hear this all the time. So what you have to do to counter these arguments is to start establishing reality. And you also have to start working with each other to realize, who do you know? What can your parents come talk? Because a lot of times, who can talk best for you? You and I both know that quality teaching is based on relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It is based, that is the absolute baseline to what happens in teaching. And in learning, it's about these relationships that you make. When you make the relationships with the parents, and you have the parents say, this teacher has helped my kid. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe my kid isn't reading where you want them to read, but they're certainly reading more than what they did before. You know, you have somebody who's got your back, so to speak. So my suggestion is to start with your local parent groups, with your community groups. We have some amazing, amazing community organizers here who are used to mobilizing, and they understand the nature of mobilizing and direct action because they do it. That's who you need to get in touch with. Again, you cannot do this by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not gonna work.
Before we get to Friday's event and the protest, I want to ask if you could explain the term. It's come up a couple times, and it's not necessarily local to Chicago, but when we're talking about turnarounds and mm-hmm. these school closures, can you explain mm-hmm. a little bit about what we're talking about?
Sure. Turnaround is a really devastating situation, because in the turnaround, the children stay in that school, but the entire staff is removed. That's from the principal to the janitors, to the lunchroom ladies, to the clerks, to the nurses, to whoever is in that building. All of the adults in the building are basically fired. Now, some other organization will come in, some contract or some other kind of entity will come in, and they will say, okay, we're going to open this school. And what they do is they allow everyone to apply for their jobs, and they rarely take more than two or three of the people that were there before. But basically, they just get rid of all the adults. So they bring in a whole new set of adults. The majority of these adults that they bring in tend to be very young, tend to be non-minority, and also tend to not know much about the community, but they, you know, have this wonderful, we're just going to come in and say, schools, we're going to do this great job. And a lot of times they have scripted curricula, which, of course, if you've never taught, scripted curricula sounds great. One of the real problems with turnarounds, of course, is that you lose veteran staff. And veterans sort of help the young ones along. I mean, there's always been those unofficial mentoring networks that go on that just cannot happen when you turn around a school, because the entire adult structure is gone. So turnarounds are very devastating. They're actually much more insidious and much more dangerous than just school closings, I think.
Can you talk a little bit about the scope of turnarounds in Chicago? Like, how many of these are we talking about in the last few years?
Oh, wow. Gee, I wish I knew. I am so sorry I don't have those data in front of me. Let me just say that the first years of school closings and then reopenings, there were like three schools that were turned around and or closed. Last year, that number was supposed to be 22. We got it down to 16 because we were able to actually save six schools off the chopping block.
I'm sorry, you said they were talking about 22 different schools were going to be turned
around? Yeah, 22 they were going to close. Absolutely.
Wow.
22 were on the list to be closed. Yep, 22. Yes. 22 schools were on the list to be closed.
It just seems totally astounding to me that they wouldn't realize that it's not just a matter of one school or one principal or one set of teachers. Or, I mean, that's such a systemic problem and it's so huge. I'm sorry.
Oh, duh. I mean, I
it's just shocking to
I mean,
me.
Right. I mean, you think I'm making this up, and we were trying to, and here's the problem. The problem is that the myth is that we could just educate our way out of this. There are two things that are really going on here. First of all, it is the easiest way to not focus on systemic deep poverty and social issues that have been swept under the rug for at least a quarter to a half a century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that we are not dealing with issues that have come up, but now we're just, oh, it's the school's fault. Oh, well, you know. So, again, if you get kids coming to school completely unprepared based on their wealthier counterparts, and when I'm saying unprepared, I'm not just talking about the parents reading. I'm talking about kids that are born with low birth weight.
Right.
We're talking about the lack of prenatal care that their moms actually have access to. This is not willful neglect of their children. I mean, and again, there's this mentality that if you're poor, you've done something wrong and you deserve to be poor. So we don't want to address these issues. So again, the way we're going to do it, we're just going to just close everything down and stop, and you know, we're going to devastate these communities. But you know, that's going to make everything work. I mean, so the scope of the turnaround is, if you can imagine. Now, granted, understand that we're talking about having in the city of Chicago, we have about 700 schools. So. But if you're, I mean, and basically what Mayor Daley said was he wanted 100 schools closed and re-imaged by the year 2010. That was his focus and his goal. Starting in 2003.
Is there any other part of the public sector that's being restructured in this way? I mean,
of course not. Absolutely not. But this is the only, listen, this is the only bastion of public funds left that the corporatists can get their hands on money. I mean, let's face it. They ruined Wall Street. Here's the other thing that's happening, and I don't know if it's happening in Santa Cruz, but it's certainly happening in Chicago. With all these people losing their jobs in the financial sector, in engineering firms and pharmaceutical companies and yada, 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 these people are all now turning around looking to education to say, I lost my job. I can always teach. I can always go teach. So what we now have is this influx of people who want to teach because they want jobs, because this is the last place where there are jobs with benefits left.
Right.
You know, because their 401ks are gone. So, no, there's no other public sector area that they're just closing down wholesale and reopening. I mean, if you look at, that's another story. I don't want to talk about that. I'm sorry. Get me off my soapbox.
No, you know what? I think we're standing right next to you.
I'm mostly curious as we're describing what sounds like machine Chicago politics, where we're talking about confronting the union. We're talking about systemic oppression, and from the small level of the school board to the large scale of a citywide system and a citywide government. You mentioned Daley, and I guess I want to ask, within that context, like how did Daley or Duncan rather come to power, and like, you know, when CORE formed, what was Arnie Duncan doing, and what's his role in some of these turnarounds and some of these process or you know, what's going on in Chicago?
Quick and dirty story. In 1995, Daley got control of the school, which is what he was saying. If you give me control of the schools, I can make them better. So what he did was to fire the black superintendent and mostly this layer of black PhDs, EDDs, who had worked their way up from teaching into district superintendents, just basically got rid of them completely. And replaced them with Paul Vallis, who you may know had a little time in Philadelphia, and something was funny about the books there, and he left under a cloud. But, of course, you know, that's been swept under the rug after he made an unsuccessful run for governor in Illinois. And then he went to New Orleans, where after Katrina, they had this wonderful opportunity because of this disaster to completely reshape the concept of public school. So now New Orleans is basically the first charter system in the entire country. And, of course, they're not doing much better, but that's another story. Arnie Duncan was Paul Vallis's second in command. What inevitably happened was Paul Vallis became, you know, sort of a cause célèbre and a little media darling, and that was too much for Mayor Daley, who has to be, you know, the big cheese, even though he's like 5'4". So Vallis was allowed to resign and take this fabulous job in Philadelphia, and Arnie Duncan, who had been basically Vallis's errand boy, rose to the top. Now, again, I think Paul Vallis had at least spent 5 minutes in a classroom, but of course Arnie Duncan hadn't. His education bona fides are basically some experience working with his mom's tutoring of disadvantaged children in her little tutoring program. That was, you know, what he did for education. But then he got this job, and how, I don't know. I mean, and the other thing is we've never been able to get his CV. Maybe now that he's the Secretary of Education, it's available. But it certainly wasn't. It certainly wasn't when we FOIA'd it several times. I could never get it, by the way. So Arnie Duncan basically is a guy who's never had an original idea. Mayor Daley is basically a dino, a Democrat in name only. He never met a civic committee man he didn't love, or a businessman who he couldn't do a deal with, or some privatization scheme. So basically, that's what this all was about, was that this one guy, Eden Martin, who was chairman of the Civic Club of Chicago, got together and decided, you know, that our schools were so terrible and had to be changed. And basically this was an opportunity to get rid of a layer of black bureaucracy and to replace it with white. And at least one of the good things that came into this was that we had more Latinos coming into the system to work now that we have a larger Latino population. So
that's
basically,
actually,
again, Arnie Duncan, he did nothing other than what Daley told him to do.
What you just said is actually an excellent segue into what we wanted to talk to you about next, the idea of replacing a layer of black with a layer of white. We want to ask you about the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
And the proposal of Chicago as a host and what that means for
youth of color,
for disadvantaged communities, for Chicago, for students.
It means disaster is what it means. Anyone that's done just the briefest investigation into what the Olympics does, we'll see very quickly that it does two things. It puts a lot of money in the hand of developers, and it gets rid of communities of color. The area that they're looking at, which is actually where I live, one of the things that started to happen about 2 years ago when this big push came was that it started gentrifying maybe about 5 to 10 years ago. But then there was this huge surge right before the housing bubble burst. And poor people were finding that they had no place to live. So what we also know is if you look at the patterns of Renaissance 2010, they were almost identical in the school turnarounds and the school closings were identical to the area that was going to be used for the Olympics. And I'm praying to God we don't get them. We can't afford them. And again, if anyone does just a cursory investigation of what it costs to run the Olympics, Montreal, which held the Olympics in 1976, just finished paying off the debt. Chicago can't afford them. We already are laying off people we're asking city workers and union workers to take furlough days. And Mayor Daley just signed an agreement with the IOC saying that, you know, we'll come up with $100 million in public funds. Where's that money coming from? The school system has a deficit, which they claim is because they have to pay a significant portion of our pensions, because they're the only school district in the state that has to pay pensions. What they don't say is that they agree to pay a higher percentage of our pension funds in lieu of giving us raises for years. So, you know, they don't ever want to deal with this, and now it's sort of come to bite them. Now they want to take pension holidays. So, again, getting back to the Olympics and Renaissance 2010 are hand-in-hand because both of these are driven by developers. And once they get their hands in the pot, and again, we cannot afford a 17-day party for developers when we have Olympic-sized issues to deal with in this city.
I mean, I don't want to seem like the totally naive one, but do they have no shame? I just don't get how this can be, you know, they can pull the wool over people's eyes that much and people aren't taking to the streets absolutely freaked out.
Well, actually, people did take to the streets when the Olympic Committee was here.
Good.
There was a huge demonstration against it here. The problem is this. When you look at the fabulous programs that are, you know, and the question is, who doesn't like the Olympics? You know, I mean,
it's totally apolitical.
Exactly. You sound like Scrooge when you say, no, we don't need this.
Right.
But when you start again, the average person has no idea. First of all, they get sold this bill of goods that we don't have to pay anything. Oh, the Olympics is going to make money. It's going to pay for itself.
It's great for the economy. Right.
That is the first lie. I was on a panel with Christopher Shaw, who wrote Five Ring Circus. I don't know if you've read that book. If you haven't, run and get it. Who is on the No Games Committee for Vancouver, the 2010. And one of the things that he said was some of the volunteers, as a matter of fact, there was a huge mass email that went out for them to come and sort of wreck our meeting. And the volunteers came and they were so earnest. And he is an earnest, wonderful man. And he looked at them and he said, you have been duped. You don't want to hear this, but you have been duped. And this is how they do. They rely on people like you who are willing to volunteer because they need volunteers, because the people who are making the money are the developers, and you are just going to be doing their bidding, and they have this free source of labor and blah, 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 plus all the public money they can get their hands on. Have they no shame? No, because it would be good for Chicago. I have heard people say to me, well, you know, I would love to go to Europe, and people stop asking me about Al Capone whenever they hear Chicago. People are going to talk about Al Capone whether we have the Olympics or not. Sorry, that's our legacy. The Olympics is not going to change that.
Uh-huh. Well, and you mentioned the politics behind it and the land grab, money for developers, et cetera, and the idea that, yeah, there's jobs for youth, or that it would be a boon to the economy, and mm-hmm. those are some of the rationales put out there.
Mm-hmm.
What would the effect be if the games were to go on one of your students?
And my students are actually a pretty good example, because I also kind of work where I live, even though I have to say, teach at a selective admissions high school, so my students come from all around the city. However, there are a lot of neighborhood kids that do go to school. I mean, the effect is this, that the amount of rent will skyrocket. For example, I have a three-bedroom, two-bath condo. For those 2 weeks, I could probably rent them out for about $20,000 a week.
Damn.
So if you're living in an apartment that some landlord can rent out for 2 weeks for basically what you would pay the entire year, what do you think is going to happen to those people? They're going to get moved out.
We're going to look at a wave of evictions.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be a huge wave of evictions. Not only that, all of the homeless people and the poor students and the people that need any kind of special services are going to disappear. They're going to disappear. They're going to be swept out of the city.
Disappear or be disappeared.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I'm a little concerned about that. I'm very concerned, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
that happens all the time. I'm sorry.
You were talking a little bit about what happened in L.A. in 84, and I thought that was really interesting that there were underground prisons that were ostensibly filled with people who had not had any sort of charges brought against them.
Right. It happened in Atlanta. And don't think it won't happen in Chicago. I mean, come on. We have a history. We have a history. And we have a mayor that's been in office forever, you know. So he basically feels there's nobody stopping him. I mean, there was some outrage from the city council about him making this decision to sign a contract with the IOC saying if we get the games, we can guarantee that $100 million of public funds will be available for this game. For a 17-day party?
Right.
No. For developers? No. No. And especially now, who can afford this?
Right,
we can't.
Absolutely.
We cannot. We cannot.
And I think there are businesses who would be very excited to host just to get the extra, you know, 17 days worth of business. But in the long haul, I think you're absolutely right.
Right. Those 17 days worth of business is not going to be 30 years worth of debt that we're saddled with.
Exactly.
Because that's what it comes down to, a 30-year debt that Mayor Daley will not be around to pay.
Right. So switching gears away from the Olympics, I think that we have a couple other things that we're going to want to air after the interview. But one thing before you go that I wanted to ask about is just sort of what do you place your faith with regards to education? What do you look to for inspiration, or how do you have hope? How do you, you know, each day knowing that things are as grim as they are here, How do you keep on with such passion and such fire?
Well, first of all, I love my job. I mean, I feel like I have died and gone to teacher heaven. I happen to have a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful working environment. I have, and after 20, this is my 21st year, because I actually started teaching late. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up either. But this was my absolute best year teaching, I have to tell you. And the reason was because I had all of the support of the parents that I've never had before. And part of that was me reaching out and doing a lot of outreach to parents. But I felt like we are in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the problems as teachers is we like to point our fingers at parents and say, well, if parents raise these kids right, you know, we wouldn't have these problems. And parents point their fingers at us and say, you know, if you were doing your job and you weren't so lazy and you weren't running out of the building at, you know, 5 minutes after the bell rings, you know. So this year, more than anything else, I have completely gotten out of the blame game. I have a very good principal who's, like, could be my son. He's very young. But he's extremely supportive, and he's very interested, and he's provided me with the kind of resources that I need to do well, to do my job well. But ultimately, I love my kids. I just, every single year, I keep saying, oh, it's not going to be last year, and I fall in love with my kids every single year. So for me, my passion is that when I do a demonstration and I blow something up and the kids' eyes just go, whoa. You know, I mean, little things, little bitty things are what push me along. And I feel like I have this huge responsibility because the parents have entrusted their students to me. Even if it's only 47 minutes a day, they've done that. And I'm going to do everything I can to make that kid a better learner. You know, I mean, ultimately, I don't care about chemistry in the long run because most kids hate it. You know, it's like, it's so hard, you know, blah, blah, blah. But what it does do is it gives them the ability to think. And to me, that's a life skill. So I sort of feel like I'm really preparing them for the next step. And I just love what I do. I mean, it's performance art. It's a chance to give back to my community. I really feel that, I mean, I'm a very, very fortunate person. I went to Chicago Public Schools, and I went to an Ivy League college. So I know that the education was there and ready to push me to the next level. So that's what inspires me. I mean, plus I'm just a geek. I love learning, you know? And as far as the union goes, I'm passionate about justice, and I cannot abide intolerance. It's like I'm intolerant to intolerant. So for me, to see things work badly and to see people be corrupt and to see people lie and to see people not do what they're supposed to do, it just sends me over the edge. So these are the things that inspire me. And again, I love what I do. So I don't think you can do this job if you don't love it. I just don't think it's possible.
Karen, thanks for taking the time out and spending time with
guys,
us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
I'm so
really
glad.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Well, send me the link so I can so we can do some more stuff. And you know, good luck in your mobilization efforts. You guys, tell 5 people, try it. Trust me, it's going to work. Don't give up. I mean, the key is you have to keep plugging because it's worth this fight. Publicly funded public education and the defense of it is worth the fight of your life.
Sounds like a good note to close on. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll be in touch.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Teachers for Class War on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, 6 to 7 p.m. every Monday.
Los niños ilustres que alegran el mundo, como pajaritos al amanecer, con esta sonrisa plasmada en su rostro, demuestran con ansias deseos de crecer. Los niños del mundo con gran inocencia, no saben de penas, maldad y tristeza. No saben que existe tanta delincuencia. No saben que existe tanta corrupción. Por eso conservan en sus corazones la esencia de niños que traen al nacer. La esencia de niños.
All right, I got time for one more. I'm the night watchman. Thank you. Count on. There's been several effects of it. One is that it hurts working families throughout the hemisphere. Another is that it depresses environmental standards. One thing they didn't count on is that it would bring into existence the movement that would prove to be its undoing. That's you. So what's past is past, but the future's unwritten. And history from this day forward is yours to make. Thank you for coming out tonight. This is House Gone Up in Flames. good. It's in the needle's rust. It's in the eagle's claw. It's in the eyes you trust. It's in the jackal's dreams. It's in the sleet and the hail. It's in the unmarked box. Came today in the mail. It's in the dead man's pocket. It's in the child's first sin. It's in the Constitution, written in very small print. It's in Colin Powell's lies. It's in the shaman's trance. It's in the cell awaiting. And it's in the best laid plans. Now we could cut and run, take half the blame. Don't stop now, that's why we came. House gone up in flames.
Three years after the Oaxacan people's victory over the state government, shots are fired at a barricade. The PFP mobilizes, and a strong megamarch fills the streets. Oaxaca sizzles and resists once more on the three-year anniversary of the people's victory in resisting an attempt to remove the teachers' encampment from the Oaxaca Zocalo on June 14, 2006. On the night of June 13th of this year, dozens of barricades were set up at various points around the city, showing that nothing has been resolved. Yet, far from being defeated, the struggle goes on. Around 4:20 in the pre-dawn hours of June 14th, 2009, a barricade set up at the Niños Héroes of Chapultepec intersection was attacked. Five spent shells from a 9mm pistol were found at the site, left behind by thugs, hired by the state government, who fired at least 10 rounds. Meanwhile, the Federal Preventative Police, the PFP, which had been arriving in small convoys all during the preceding month and establishing themselves in hotels like the Parador Crespo, staged an operation aimed at taking over La Ley radio station, where the APO member and architect Lozano San Pablo Cervantes was killed 3 years ago by agents of the Ulysses Ruiz government. Before the shots were fired last Sunday, several late-model cars pulled up near the barricade and did provocative aggressive maneuvers. A Volkswagen Bora and several vans accelerated erratically. One of them almost ran over someone, and another drove into the side of the barricade. Later, the shots aimed at APO members were fired from this vehicle. APO members accused the state and federal governments of the killer Ulysses Ruiz and Felipe Calderon of complicity in the early morning repressive acts, and held them responsible for all psychological and physical damage done to anyone, given that the PFP operation and the shots against the barricade were ordered precisely at points where people were demanding punishment of the of Lozano San Pablo Cervantes' killers. Early in the morning of June 14th, the people came out into the streets to demonstrate once more. Thousands and thousands of women and men arrived at the Vigueira intersection to set out on the mega march. Yet just before starting out, people were filled with sadness and indignation at the death of another of their sons. An explosion was felt at the starting point, where a truck carrying fireworks exploded, leaving at least 10 people injured, three of whom had serious wounds. As of now, the death of a teacher named Alberto Gasca Varenga has been confirmed. It's important to mention that in several parts of the city there was heavy police buildup, including uniformed cops and civilians on motorcycles and truckloads of full of state police forces riding around. On the other hand, the mega march has shown that people's dreams are still alive. Thousands and thousands of people formed human rivers that flooded the streets of Oaxaca, demanding freedom for all political prisoners, the live presentation of disappeared people, and punishment for the murders of dozens of comrades, in addition to the teacher killed today. Or, I guess, killed on June 14th. Chants, graffiti, posters, and t-shirts express the outrage of these 3 long years of struggle, as well as an unbreakable will to triumph, with a tremendous force that hasn't been displayed in quite some time. Solidarity was shown in each and every city street, with doors and windows of their houses wide open. People applauded the march of thousands and thousands of their brothers and sisters, who meant what they shouted when they said, "If Ulysses doesn't leave, peace will never come." An enormous mobilization with contingents from Morelos and other states made it clear that the sense of defeat among peoples of Oaxaca is non-existent, and that they are still ready to struggle. From the Valley of Oaxaca, the people of Zachila arrived with a resounding no against the imposition of the extension of the turnpike in their territory. As the multitude of people approached down to the downtown area, the march grew even bigger. Thousands and thousands of women and men, full of anger, hope, and a will to struggle, milled around on every city street corner, every stairwell, every sidewalk, every street, shouting and applauding and making it clear at every step of the way, the struggle is not over. It's not true. It's a lie. Nothing has been decided. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, Ulysses killer, your debt is overdue. Showing one more time that Oaxaca is not at peace. That was read from elenemigocomun.net.